the Business and Labor Committee to order.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Will we open the hearing first time? I want to get this on record.
On 961?
Yes, please.
Just a point of information that I shared before, but now that it's on the record, Senator Morris is here. We're going to take him on Senate Bill 961. However, we will, after that, continue to follow through with the schedule. So 961 will be heard third, and today is our next-to-last meeting. So there are some fiscals that are not yet in, and that's absolute drop date. That will be our only and remaining meeting. Okay, with that, we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 961. Chair Schaffner.
I have to go down and see what time I'm testifying in two bills in hearing room D. I just wanted to say I completely, absolutely support Senate Bill 961. I support the amendment. I do not think that subcontractors should be responsible for the liability of a general. I am thoroughly disappointed in people showing up to work late. Not my committee. I'm talking about the people that oppose this. I work for Hoffman Construction myself. And I'm grateful they're in the state. I'm grateful they're building America. And I'm grateful they got a bunch of my union brothers and sisters working there. They had every opportunity to address this in the Senate, and they didn't. And I told Mr. Harmon, if I showed up to work late at Morris Brothers, where I work too, and I had the opportunity to work, or Hoffman late, there's a stack of applications, a bunch of hungry guys and gals they put in my place if I was late to work. They showed up late. I'm really upset with how this process is unfolding. I'm disappointed. I want to pass this bill, this session, out of this committee, next Wednesday. I hope we have the votes. I just wanted to share that with the good senator and apologize to him because I have to leave.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Schaffler. Okay. With that, please introduce yourself, Senator, and let's proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kinnemer, and thank you to Co-Chair Schaffler and colleagues. For the record, I'm Frank Morris. I represent Lynn and Benton Counties, District 8 in the Oregon Senate. The issue that gives rise to Senate Bill 961 is one of assumption of responsibility for negligence in construction contracts. That's the basic issue. There was a time when owners and general contractors, through the power inherently provided in a contract agreement between those who possessed the power and those who did not, that would pass their own negligence to subcontractors through contract language. The circumstance gave rise to the adoption of ORS 30.140, which states, and I would like to quote that, any provision in a construction agreement that requires a person or that person's surety or insurer to indemnify another against liability for damage arising out of death or bodily injury to persons or damage to property caused in whole or in part by the negligence of the indemnity is void. That language exists in Oregon statute. Contracts that require subcontractors to indemnify the owners, reps, and agents, and the general contractor for any and all negligence, whether caused in whole or in part by the owner or the owner's reps and general contractor, is determined to be void. That's existing law. It is an interesting twist of irony that ORS 30.140 was legislation that was introduced at my request in the early 90s when I was president of Morse Brothers. The legislation adopted in ORS 30.140 was subsequently clarified in the Oregon Supreme Court's 2005 decision in Walsh versus Mutual of Enumclaw. And quite interestingly, the court quoted the testimony I gave before the Judiciary Committee as clarifying language with respect to the intent of the law. So it's interesting how testimony in the process is determinative to interpretation of the statutes that are in fact adopted. Senate Bill 961 again addresses the basic intent of ORS 30.140, and that is simply that each party to a contract should bear the responsibility and the cost of their own negligence, not to change the intent of ORS 140 or the decision in Walsh, but to clarify that the statute also applies to subrogation waivers that extend beyond what is normally applied to property damage claims into the area of third-party workers' compensation claims. For example, a general contractor's employee could seriously injure a subcontractor's employee. The subcontractor pays the workers' compensation cost. The injured worker files a third-party claim against the general contractor, and the general contractor tenders the suit back to the subcontractor to defend and assume all responsibility for damages.
Yeah, sitting here, thanks.
That's a very serious issue.
That's okay.
The subcontractor winds up paying twice, once through the workers' compensation system, and the second time by tender from the general contractor and the waiver of subrogation language in the contracts for the negligence of the general contractor. The intent of Senate Bill 961 is that each party to a contract should assume responsibility for their own negligence. I might add that, and just give you a little bit of background as to what gave cause to this initial request for clarification of negligence that found its way into 30.140. We were subcontractors on a project, an I-5 paving project. And we had completed our work. We were off the job. We had no responsibility for the temporary protection and direction of traffic. There was an unfortunate accident. A young man drove his vehicle off the highway, a straight section of I-5, rolled the vehicle, and subsequently became a paraplegic, filing a claim against the general contractor, who by virtue of this language that was imposed in that contract, and we were a subcontractor and we signed it. Because I'll tell you why we signed it, is we needed the work. It was a period of time when the economy was virtually in the tank. So we signed that contract. The general contractor tendered it back to us and said, you shall indemnify us for this claim, which subsequently turned into over a $5 million judgment. It occurred at a time in the insurance markets being a hard market, and the most insurance that we could pay for, and we were a fairly good-sized company at that time, was a $2 million policy. So here we were, bare for over $3 million. So that gave rise to, what really is the right thing to do in agreements. If you have someone that has power by virtue of controlling who is the sub and who is not the sub, to impose language that transfers their responsibility for negligence down to the lowest level, is that the right thing to do? Senate Bill 30.14, or not Senate Bill, but the statute 30.140 makes it very clear that those responsibilities shall be, negligence shall be attributed to the party who's has incurred that negligence. What we find is, and you'll hear testimony, is that this intent of 30.140 has now shifted to a new method of shifting negligence into the employer liability law. That is a very complicated issue. Does it need to be addressed? Yes. Third-party claims? It should be addressed, and it must be addressed. But this bill will clarify the intent of where negligence really lies and that it cannot be assigned by contract. So, Mr. Chair, or Co-Chair, Co-Chair Schaffler, I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify and be responsive to questions. If not, I have other
good
commitments.
Now, we have the Dash 4 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supportive of these?
Yes.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Schaffler.
Thank you. I'm going to repeat what I said because the good people I wanted to hear it weren't in the room yet. First of all, you're right, Senator. You shouldn't be responsible for my negligence or vice versa, period. We had a work group where you put it together last week. Even people that were opposed to this bill, which are now neutral with the amendment, all of them agreed, everyone agreed, that these provisions are illegal. I'm not a lawyer, but illegal is illegal. If they're illegal, we got to do something about it. I agree the third-party issue has to be addressed. I'm interested in at least going discussing that during the interim. But that's not what we're doing here. And once again, when I was working for Morse Brothers or I was working for Hoffman, if I showed up to work late, y'all had stacked of applications, a bunch of hungry guys and gals would take my place. This bill passed 28-0 out of the Senate, 5-0 out of committee, and all of a sudden, one contractor can show up in this building and derail something that's going to take illegal provisions out of a contract. They're illegal. That's what our legislative council says. That's what everyone in the room said. So if this bill doesn't pass, so be it. I'm only one guy. I can only have one vote. But I'm very frustrated with the process. I'm frustrated people come flying here at the end of the day and derail something that's going to take illegal provisions out of contracts. They're spreading. Those provisions are spreading like wildfire. Government agencies are putting them in now. It frustrates me to no end. But that all being said, I appreciate you coming, and I'll just...
Mr. Chair, do you want to clarify how you feel?
Yes, sir. I got another half an hour, I will.
I just hate it when you get diplomatic and I don't understand you.
Yeah, sometimes, we need to work on English only.
I got some English, but I can't use it in here.
I think that's what I was referring to. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I wonder if you might just talk a little bit about the amendment process on this bill, what was intended behind the amendments, and how has that influenced the final product that we see before us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Kenmer, and Representative Johnson. One of the great concerns is that when you have established, you create the statute, and then you have interpretation of that statute at the highest level in Oregon, in the Oregon Supreme Court, is that we do not do anything to unwind that or change the interpretation. The intent of moving the new language into a new section, working with legislative counsel, they're quite confident that that will not impinge or affect or change that original language and its interpretation in the courts. And so that is one of the concerns that we had in that, and it's reflected in the amendment. And I would defer to the attorneys that have far more understanding of that mm-hmm. issue.
But it is your view that the dash fours should not...
What? It's A3, excuse me. It's A3.
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 Excuse me.
It's only A3.
The A3 is. Will it's your anticipation they have the impact of maintaining the Walsh decision?
Right. We do, Mr. Chair, we do believe that. In the work group, there were two basic principles that we were working on. One was that parties should, in fact, assume responsibility for their own negligence. That is not something that was disputed.
Yeah.
At least in the work group.
Yeah, thank you. That was good clarification.
At least in the work group. And the other issue is do not do anything to unwind the Walsh versus Enumclaw Supreme Court decision. And so that's why we carefully constructed the placement of the amended language.
I appreciate you coming back and clarifying that. Are there any further questions or comments?
Oh, one more thing.
Chair Schaffler.
I worked for four contractors when I was in union, Morse Brothers, Hoffman Construction, Pardue Masonry, and Robertson Hand Wallace. And I want to thank every one of those companies for giving me the opportunity to make a good living union wage with benefits and health care for me and my family. And God bless everyone. I know you're out there creating jobs, and we're building America, and you're not going to find a stronger advocate for that in this building. So I don't want anyone to think I'm not grateful for that opportunity to make a living, because I've spent many happy days pouring concrete for Hoffman. And sometimes that shovel looks pretty gosh darn good from here. But I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you very much.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Senator. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 961. We'll take it back up in its regular order as scheduled today. And with that, we will open the hearing on Senate Bill 485.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard Senate Bill 485 on April the 4th. The measure allows the real estate agency to issue a cease and desist order subject to the Administrative Procedures Act and maintain action for an injunction against a person who engages or is about to engage in professional real estate activity without a license. You have in front of you, members, two separate amendments that were discussed. The topics were discussed during the public hearing. The dashboard specifically deletes the provisions relating to the Administrative Procedures Act and inserts new language that allows a person who has been issued a cease and desist order to request a contested case with hearing within 20 days after the date of service and also outlines further procedures. The Dash 5 amendment deletes provisions pertaining to procedures for issuing the cease and desist order and the ability for the Attorney General, County Prosecuting Attorney, or the Real Estate Agency to maintain an action for an injunction. The Dash 5 establishes that the Real Estate Agency must give appropriate notice for of the cease and desist order and then also outlines the specifics on the process for the order.
Now, Teresa, I understand that there are some plans to draft some additional amendments.
That is my understanding, yes, Mr. Chair. And that has literally within the last few minutes been started.
I see. I guess Chair Schaffler was just whispering in my ear that maybe we should talk about the proposed amendments rather than rehashing history. That might be a more appropriate way to deal with the reality of where we are. Is that?
Mr. Chair, I think we have a couple of associations in here. If they want to come up and talk to us about what we are going to do and should do, rather than battling out over what we are at this point not going to do. That's really what I'd rather approach it with the agreement of the committee.
Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping advocates that makes sense to you as well. I think maybe that, because I have quite a list of people to speak, but I think what we would anticipate is I'd like to hear about, in brief, what you're thinking about, if there seems to be consensus, or whatever there is, or that there isn't, whatever it is, I guess I want to hear about. And then, assuming that it's something along those lines, we would anticipate rescheduling it for next Wednesday, and that would be the final time, and it's going out or under, one way or another. So that's the way I would see it. Okay, so I'm not quite sure who I should bring to the table. Okay, and Ms. Kahn, thank you. And anybody else, or is this probably the right group?
Mr. Chair, I believe he's in Legislative Council right now, the individual you're looking for, yes.
Okay. Yes. Please give us your name for the record, and let's proceed, and let's talk about where we are.
Good morning. Chair Kinnamer, Co-Chair Schaffler. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager at the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. I've just had conversations with a representative from Senator Bonamici's office, Sean Gillians from the Oregon Association of Realtors, and Sean advised that he had spoken with Mr. Kahn about drafting proposed amendments that are significantly different than the Dash A4 or the Dash A5 amendments, and the Senator's office, the association, and the real estate agency and Mr. Kahn are all in agreement about what those amendments would look like.
Now, you mentioned Senator Bonamici as well?
Yes. I just spoke with Leslie, her aide who came to testify, and they're good with these amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair Schaffler.
Her assistant said the senator is okay with these amendments. God bless staff, but they don't have a vote on the floor. The senator is okay. That's what you're telling us.
Co-Chair Schaffler, Co-Chair Kinnamer, let me rephrase. We spoke about the amendments. The amendments basically mirror the provisions in another statute for the Board of Accountancy. Those provisions mirror ORS Chapter 183, the Administrators Procedures Act, for notice on a contested case hearing, and so that notice would be parallel provisions. So Senator Bonamici nor her aide have seen the amendments, nor have they opined on the amendments.
All right.
So,
thank you.
And just on that point, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator had asked that it move without amendments, so this would be a change, and we'll be looking to see what she has to say.
Very good. I apologize.
That's quite all right. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kanemar and Co-Chair Schauffler. Jared Kahn, I represent, as you guys know, the Northwest Real Estate Investors Association. We did propose and work with the representatives on the committee on the amendments A4 and A5. What we've now reached an agreement with Sean Gillian and the Oregon Association of Realtors and the Real Estate Agency, and what we're hoping for Senator Bonamici to also sign off on is language that essentially adopts the verbiage in the accountant bill cease and desist order language here for the real estate agency to have authority. We came to a determination that certainly the reason they have these procedures in the statute outlining the notice in the hearing was because the APA actually doesn't provide for it specifically, and that's why they wrote those into those statutes for the accountant bill. You know, there's a reason that the legislatures actually include that when the APA doesn't provide for it. So we are on board with the language. Obviously, we haven't seen the formal proposed amendment, which will seem to be A6 coming out of legislative council yet, but it seems like we're all on board with that language, and we can move forward with the bill providing the real estate agency with that authority.
Any questions or comments? Okay, so at this point, we anticipate we will reschedule this bill for hearing and possible work session next Wednesday.
Great. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to speak on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 485.
384.
We will open a hearing on Senate Bill 384.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 384A passed unanimously out of the Senate Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee and off the Senate floor with a 21-9 vote. The measure revises the billing cycle and construction contracts from 30 days to a monthly cycle. It also changes the statement requirement for alternative billing cycles and allows for the specification of an alternative time limit for making final payment and allowing the prevailing party in disputes over interest to collect reasonable attorney fees. You have in front of you, members, a -A3 amendment replaces the entire components of the bill, but it maintains the majority of the ingress measures provisions. The amendment clarifies the definition of a construction contract, deletes the newly established definition of plans, and replaces terminology plans with drawings, and restores the term specifications throughout the measures provisions. It also maintains the provisions regarding the progress payments for construction contracts that are expected to take more than 60 days to complete, the terminology change from 30 days to monthly billing cycles, and the establishment of consistent terms such as construction contract for contract and opt-out provisions for final payments. And we are waiting for the fiscal and revenue on the amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jeremy Vermillion, please.
Can you get it back?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. First of all, thanks for scheduling the bill at all. I understand there was some question about that. I've had the opportunity to speak to a few of you about
this. You need to give us your name for the record.
Sorry, Jeremy Vermillion. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Schwabe, Williamson, & Wyatt in Portland, Oregon. I'm also on the executive committee of the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Section, the proponents of this legislation. First of all, let me start by saying this bill is intended to be a technical fix. There are a number of issues with the original legislation that was passed in 2003. The Oregon Private Prompt Pay Act was promoted by essentially parties who were concerned that they were being strung along in terms of the payment process. The bill was attempting to create a scenario whereby prime contractors and owners had certain time limits within which they had to pay their downstream contractual partners, and created interest penalty provision to be able to enforce that. So the legislation before you is an attempt to clean that original legislation up. There are basically four things that the bill does. The principal issues addressed in the legislation include providing progress payments to contractors that are currently required to be made in a 30-day cycle under the Private Prompt Pay Act, but the industry standard is to basically bill monthly. And the fact that the statute says 30 days means that any time your billing cycle takes place on 31 days, you're technically in violation of the statute. And this creates a problem whereby every contractor or owner is at peril of ending up in a penalty interest situation because they've missed the deadline by one day just because of the way the calendar works. So we have changed the language to remove 30 days, replace it with monthly. We've also cleaned up some inconsistent language. There's use of alternate, alternative, contract for construction contract, which is a defined term, and various iterations of plan, specifications, and addenda for what is the customary terminology, which is drawings and specifications. So we've tried to clean up those ambiguities, make it more clear, more consistent with industry practice. The other thing we've done is we've modified the attorney fee provision to make it more consistent with the Public Prompt Pay Act, which provides for the recovery of attorney's fees in the event of a dispute or litigation arising out of the recovery of penalty interest in the event that a contractor or an owner does not comply with the Prompt Pay statute. The prior language was open to inconsistent interpretations, and we've tried to clean it up so that it's very clear what when your rights to recover attorney fees in a dispute are. There are opt-out notices in the original bill that prescribe for three of the four prompt payment deadlines in the OPPA. There was no apparent reason why the fourth deadline, the time for final payment, was also not provided an opt-out, so we've corrected that in this bill as well. Now, subsequent to the initial drafting, we amended it to remove the definition of plans, which was inserted as part of the initial drafting process, and replace that with industry terminology, and we've used the word drawings throughout the bill, and we've taken out a definitional term in the original amendments. So we've made that, we think, more consistent. We believe that these changes will make the OPPA function better for private contractors and their clients. We think the way that the original bill was drafted, it was essentially unusable. Prime contractors and owners were consistently at risk of being in violation of the bill and being subject to potential penalty interest. Subcontractors were loath to enforce it because it's a very cumbersome and difficult to understand statute. So we've tried to clean it up for the benefit of all parties to construction contracts. Our role is not to pass judgment on the wisdom of the underlying policies that were embodied in the original legislation, but rather to make the law itself more usable with fewer ambiguities and potential pitfalls. We believe that 384 does make the existing law more usable and will benefit both prime contractors and subcontractors. I know there have been some questions regarding why the original statute required a legend on every page of the contract drawings and specifications, and I anticipate a question about that, so I'll try to address that now. My understanding, again, this bill was passed in 2003. I was not involved in the drafting, but my understanding is it was essentially done so that downstream parties, subcontractors and suppliers who may have involvement in a very small scope of work, who may not get the full set of drawings, full set of specifications, but who, for example, look only at the structural portion of the drawings, have the opportunity to be on notice at the start of the bidding process that there may be an alternative billing cycle, there may be an alternative payment cycle, there may be an extended period of time to certify payment, etc., so that those parties can anticipate that in how they structure their bids and how they structure their work. I think it's also important to note that the default in this legislation is that the normal payment cycle is a billing cycle is a monthly cycle. The default is that the payment cycle is a 14-day cycle after receipt and certification of payment, and that the default on a certification of a pay request or a billing is 10 days after receipt of that billing. As if a contractor or an owner intends to comply or continue to operate using the defaults that are in statute, then they need to do nothing else. They do not need to put anything on their drawings, specifications, contracts. They don't need to do anything other than just basically comply with what those deadlines are. It is only at a point where they wish to extend from a monthly to a quarterly or a 60-day billing cycle, or where they wish to extend payments from 14 days to 30 days after receipt, something along those lines, where the modifications that are set forth in the bill arise and where then they have to notify their downstream parties. So again, the default is if you're complying with the basic timing that's in the Prompt Pay Act, you don't have to do anything more than that. And with that, I will answer any questions that anyone has.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Questions? Comments?
Good explanation.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 384?
Okay. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 384.
Can we move into the work session?
We don't have a fiscal amendment.
The Facebook
so,
or what?
Mr. Chair, so you know, if you wanted to hold off or...
There is an amendment. Though.
There is an amendment, yes. I'm waiting for the analysis on the... I did receive the revenue analysis this morning, but I have not seen the fiscal.
Would it be helpful if we move the amendment in?
If you wish, Mr. Chair.
I think what we ought to do, we're going to have to carry this over because we don't have a fiscal till Wednesday, but we might as well put the amendment in so we take that formal action would be my view.
Sounds good.
Mr. Chair, I didn't quite hear what you said.
I suggested that we have an amendment to add to this bill, that we have a brief work session, put the amendment in, and then carry the bill over for final action on Wednesday since we don't have a fiscal.
Wednesday
Mr. Chair, we have three people missing.
We have five. That's a quorum.
Well, I understand.
Wouldn't
we like to hear input from them, maybe?
Well, we're just going to put the amendment in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have objection to that amendment?
No.
Okay. Well, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 384. Somebody want to move that we put the amendment in?
I move that we put the A3 amendment into the bill.
Okay, Representative Doherty moves the A3 amendment to be added to Senate Bill 384. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, it is unanimous, and so ordered. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 384 and reschedule it for a possible work session on Wednesday. Okay, our next item is, our next item is returning to the hearing on Senate Bill 961. And
please go in order this one.
I guess we'll just take these in the order in which they're here, if that's agreeable. Stephen Fry, Rick Thomas, and Dan O'Brien.
Issues that are driving the move forward, but also something can't be addressed in this, but it's something that has to be addressed.
Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Steve Fry. I'm a vice president with Knife River Corporation. We're in Oregon. We have our operations in Oregon. What I'm coming to you today is to in support of this bill. And I want to talk about the impact to our company and what this bill aims to change. Subrogation clauses in contracts basically preclude us from seeking reimbursement when a prime contractor owner is responsible for some liability or fault. And many attorneys have varying opinions on whether this is already covered by ORS 30.14. I think you've heard earlier today history on it. Most of the time, we are able to negotiate these clauses out, but many times now we are unable to do that. And I would say it's getting to be more and more. Just this year, it's been added to public contracts, City of Bend, City of Redmond. We've never seen them in the past in those. And it's very difficult to negotiate with a public entity. If you negotiate anything, you're just thrown out. This year, with private contracts, large contractors, $4 million worth of work I would have had to turn away. For a company even our size, $4 million worth of work represents a lot of jobs. Over the last 3 years, I've had 2,600 employees 3 years ago. I have 1,200 employees now. The impact is severe, and we are not in the position to negotiate them out any longer. The So we've been working on this bill for literally months, and we've been working through. We've worked hard with the bar, with concerns over Walt. We've worked with AGC, subcontracting community, trying to get language that really just says we all accept our own liability. We're not asking to defer any of our own. We're just asking not to accept someone else's. I'd like to give to you examples of these type of clauses. So I have some here, and if I could put them in the record, do I need to give them to?
Mm-hmm. Please, Shelley will take them for you. Thank you.
I'd also like to add to the record my position paper that supports the bill.
They know how it works.
So you'll read, I'm not going to go over that language, I'll let you read them, but I think just in reading them you'll see how aggressive they are and how unfair they seem. As I understand it, we've had a prime contractor come up and talk about that these are required clauses, that they need these clauses to address work comp claims. I'd like to go over an example so that I can put the practical issue in front of you. The scenario would be, and I'm going to keep it simple with the scenario, the subcontractor's employee, I'll say that that's me in this case, is working on a job. We're doing a paving job in a parking lot. Somebody's putting in a catch basin, and the prime contractor's superintendent is driving through the parking lot, checking the job, doesn't see our employee, runs the employee over, he's severely injured. What's going to happen is our workers' comp is going to respond to that. We're going to have to pay all of those expenses. And so that will occur. And then maybe a year down the road or 2 years down the road, there's going to be a time when the employee themselves have a choice. They can go in two routes. They can either say workers' comp is fine, and then the employer will go and ask for reimbursement. That's called a subrogation claim. That's what they're trying to bar with this language. We're asking for reimbursement because the cause of the injury was the superintendent of that party. The second way that reimbursement could happen is the employee could choose to take that claim themselves. And what they use a lot of times is a law that was predated work comp called Employer's Liability Law.
That's interesting. Thank you.
In that law, there's no workers' comp rules on it. This is a straight liability issue that they go against the prime contractor who ran over them, and it goes to a regular jury trial, and there's fault, and they go through that process. I've heard that the prime contractor is saying, well, they need these waivers to protect them from that type of a claim. Well, I don't believe that it applies in that type of a claim. There is no subrogation because what would happen is us as the subcontractor would place a lien on that liability suit that the employee made against the prime, and we'd recover our costs based on that lien. And it'd either be at fault or not at fault. That would be decided by the court. But so I don't think that work comp, other than when we're, as a subcontractor, asking for reimbursement through a subrogation claim, I don't believe that the two issues mix. Now, is there unfairness in the ELA claims? Many times there are, but it's a separate issue. It has nothing to do with what we're asking for in clarification here. So if you guys have questions on that, I'll take those, but I would like to close with one thing. I asked the prime contractor if they would sign these waiver subrogation clauses. The response was, no, are you kidding? And I said, well, why are you asking us to do it? And the answer was, because I can. That's directly from someone I was trying to negotiate with.
It's not too much negotiation, is it?
Okay. Questions, comments? Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
Just to respond to the conclusion there, and then I have a couple of questions about your testimony. I think that general contractors are very often required to sign a very similar provision by the owner of the project.
It happens. This bill would also restrict that.
Understood. And I actually think that's an important point. I do understand it, but I wanted to clarify. If they said they wouldn't sign a provision like that, they are signing a provision like that.
They're sometimes forced into it by owners.
My understanding, and this is an informal survey, but you know, it's probably 80% of the contracts that they enter into. Even the city of Bend has a similar provision in its form contract. So may I continue?
Yes, sir. For a second? Additional question or comment. Go ahead.
So I understand the problem that you're trying to resolve. It seems to me that it doesn't get to the underlying issue, which is, and let me explain that. If we're trying to place liability with the bad actor, so that if you do something wrong or you're negligent, you neglect your responsibilities, liability should be pointed at you. As a policy matter, I think we all agree on that. You said in your testimony, everyone agreed that that's true.
That's true.
Right now, through contract, subcontractors are bearing liability for, in certain circumstances, bad acts of the prime contractor. If we clarify that those contractual provisions are illegal, then what happens is the gun just points the other way, if I understand this correctly. So that in that case, in certain instances, the prime contractor can be responsible for liability that it had no part in. And the example that I would give is if you had an employee as a subcontractor, let's say you're a, I can't think of a good example, but a heating subcontractor, and the employee falls through the ceiling and is injured, you're protected as the subcontractor from liability in most instances because you have workers' compensation. If there's no contractual provision in your contract with the prime, the employee can still sue the prime contractor after collecting workers' compensation benefits. So that's what these contractual provisions, in part at least, are aimed at, is correcting that inequity. What would you do about that scenario? So if we pass this bill, we point the gun the other way, we've solved it for subcontractors, we've now, the problem still exists, it's just on another group.
Representative Conger, I don't believe that the gun points the other direction. Now, like you said, the subcontractor or the employer, let's say it's the employer, because it could be the prime too, has workers' compensation insurance. It is a no-fault system, but they're going to pay. They're going to pay, and it's going to be covered by insurance. Now, if there's a secondary suit because there is a belief that someone else is responsible, it's a scenario I went through both ways it could happen. One, it could be the insurer employer making the claim, and they're asking for a subrogation. Or the employee can make the claim. Now, if the employee makes the claim, and I think this is the one that you're outlining, what happens is the subcontractor or their insurer makes a lien against that claim for reimbursement. So really, there's only one payment. It's a double shot at the apple. The employee gets to do work comp if they're happy with it. That's fine. But they do have a second opportunity if a third party's involved to make a regular lawsuit outside of work comp. But work comp has the right to lien against that suit to recover costs. So overall, what the double jeopardy that I think primes, and I've faced this too as a prime, is that you're not only responsible under work comp, but if the employee is unhappy with work comp, they might make a suit against you if you have fault. They still have to prove fault. You have to defend it. And if you're not at fault, they'll lose, and work comp will still pay. But if they win, they could get dollars well in excess of what you would see in a work comp claim. But the work comp carrier and the subcontractor will be reimbursed for their cost to the extent of that recovery.
Okay, additional question, Representative Conger.
I think this is my last question. I appreciate that. That's helpful and does clarify a little bit. Wouldn't that apply in the case that you were mentioning where the contractual provision assigns the liability for the lawsuit down to the subcontractor? So you really wouldn't be double paying justice?
Now what it would be is in the case where I'm making the claim, the waiver of subrogation precludes me from making that claim. I can't go back against the prime or the owner because of this waiver of subrogation clause.
I'm sorry, that wasn't the nature of the question. I probably wasn't very articulate about it. No, it's okay. Let me try to clarify. What I meant was if workers' comp can then lien the employee's suit in the case where the lawsuit's against the prime, then isn't it so that if it is then assigned, the liability eventually makes its way down to the subcontractor, wouldn't the same thing happen? So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you would only pay under work comp in that case.
Well, you pay under one or the other. I guess what I thought I heard you testify is that subcontractors pay double in this case because they're paying increased workers' compensation rates, plus they're paying for the liability that makes its way from the lawsuit against the prime down to the subcontractor through the contract.
Typically, I don't believe on an ELLA claim that any of the provisions that we're asking for in this bill apply. It only applies when we're trying to get reimbursement. And you're right, it does increase our insurance costs, and to the point that we may not even be insured. I asked to get separate insurance for this from our carrier, Liberty Mutual. They refused to give me the coverage. They won't do it on a job-by-job basis. The only way they'll do it is to put it into our own experience, which drives up our costs and lowers the cost of the primes. The primes are responsible for it, but they're lowering their cost by putting these provisions into construction contracts. It's not, I don't believe that there's equity in that.
I think you're right. I understand. The point that I was making is that it's the same for the prime as it is for the subcontractor. All of the things that you just said about driving up your insurance cost or being difficult to insure against that kind of liability, isn't that true for the prime as well?
Mm-hmm. I don't believe it's the same circumstance because the only circumstance that would drive up their insurance cost is if they are actually at fault. So if they're at fault, wouldn't it be appropriate for it to drive up their insurance cost? Where the problem is when they're at fault and they restrict us from getting reimbursement from them, then they don't they have the responsibility, but they don't have the cost. And all we're asking to do is not be responsible for their acts by forcing us to accept waivers of subrogation, which don't allow us to recoup our costs when they're at fault. Subrogation can only occur if they have fault.
Okay. We're going to have another panel, right?
Yes, we've got some more people scheduled. Anyone else? Further questions on this witness?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I can understand not wanting to sign something somebody else wouldn't. That I find interesting. I certainly want to make every injured worker whole. I think once that injured worker is whole, I think, you know, that I can see why one would say that's enough, that's sufficient. I'm very interested in examining this issue of you get a workers' comp claim, you're made whole, then you go sue somebody else to get more. I struggle with that one. My union brothers and sisters and some trial lawyers, I don't know where they're going to come down on all that, but I can see the logic in not allowing that to happen. I can understand, I'm sympathetic to that. But I certainly have a problem with someone, one party, paying for the negligence of another. That I can't grasp that either. But I really do appreciate Representative Conger's conversation and just shedding light on that, on this whole process. It's rather frustrating for a layman, and I do appreciate your questioning. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were discussing with Representative Conger the concept of fault. It seems to me that that could be what can be difficult to define sometimes. You know, the system can define that in different ways, and as I put myself in the position of a general, I could be at fault just by virtue of being the originator of a project on which an infraction or some unfortunate accident occurs. So it seems to me that the system is a little nebulous, perhaps, in how it defines that, and that may be the source of some of this litigation that occurs as we find some creative definitions of who ultimately or who really is at fault. So I'm not, it's more of a comment, I guess, than a question, but it seems to me that the system isn't perfect in how it defines those things, and I would love for us to be able to work to some way to bring some sort of more clarity to that in statute or in legislation or whatever, but from the general's perspective, I can appreciate that, because somebody is always going to be at fault other than the person who feels that they were wronged or has the case. So,
Representative Johnson, I, if I may, we had work sessions, and in our first work session, we talked about ELA and the need to do work on it, and as a group in that work session, we said that we would like to work on in the next session the ELA law. But they are separate issues, and so we agreed as a work group that we would try to work on that.
One more follow-up. We've heard the senator reference this work group, and you did too. Could you, just for the record, tell us who participated in that work group? Because I think that's important too, yes, for us to understand.
In the work group, we had AGC, the Oregon State Bar, myself, Knife River. We had Associated Building Contractors Group. Those are the ones that come to mind right now. There was, I think, Home Builders Association was also there.
OCAPA.
There was a number of groups that came together to work
OCAPA
on this.
I think was OCAPA there?
The Concrete Aggregate Producers.
Concrete Aggregate Producers Association.
Yes, sorry. You might remember those folks.
Okay.
Representative Doherty.
I have a quick question. So basically what this legislation is it does not require in a construction contract that you would sign as a sub to go through and abrogate your right
to subrogate a claim when it's the fault of someone else.
And so that's basically what the entire bill is.
That's what the
contractor can't force you to sign something that could take the liability away from that contractor and put it on you for their mistakes.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. You know, just a comment here. Let's focus a little bit to get through. We've got some more testimony and another bill yet.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas, please.
Chairman Kenemer, Co-Chair Kenemer, Co-Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Thomas, representing the Associated Builders and Contractors and Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. I'll keep my comments fairly brief and just introduce Dan O'Brien with Kern Electrical Construction, who participated in some of the discussions on behalf of our contractors. We support Senate Bill 961 and the amendments that that have been come up with today, and I guess turn it over to him for additional comments and background.
Okay. Mr. O'Brien, please.
Co-chairs, my name is Dan O'Brien. I'm president of Kern Electrical Construction Company in Portland, Oregon. I'm a member of AGC and a member of the Independent Electrical Contractors. I've been in the construction industry for 30 years, both as an employee and an employer. This is kind of the third leg of the holy grail of specialty contracting, talking about payment, retention, and now we're into indemnification and the clauses thereof. These contracts are non-negotiable. We don't have any of our contractors that we can negotiate any of this term, this specifically terms and conditions, any of the subcontracts that we sign. And it is very onerous for us to be there. It costs us more in insurance. We have, depending on which subcontract that we actually receive, we send that to our insurance company, and our insurance company sends us back a bill as to an additional rider that they have to put on to our policy to be able to cover the different terms and conditions that our general contractors actually give us. I'm a small guy. I'm a small contractor out there. I do read my subcontracts. I can guarantee you that most of my, or a significant number of my competitors out there and compatriots of the subcontracting industry do not. And so they don't even know these terms and conditions actually exist, which is sad. And we haven't done a good job of educating these people. And most of these guys are under $2.5 million in volume. A significant number under $1 million in volume. And this impacts everybody from the minority community all the way through to larger specialty contractors in the industry. This is not just an Oregon problem, by the way. This is something that's been discussed at committee on a national basis, which I participated in for the last 20 years. And this is the number one issue and the biggest problem that we have trying to solve. As far as myself is concerned and the independent electrical contractors, we support this bill. We'd like to be able to close the loop and close the door, but the biggest complaint that I have associated with what's happening here is the issue of trying to determine who's at fault. If we sign an agreement with a general contractor, the most money is spent right up front trying to go through and find out who is actually at fault for that accident. Somebody talked about falling through the ceiling. You have to go up and figure out who was supposed to put the guardrails in place, who didn't protect that guy from actually coming through the ceiling, and investigate that accident to find out who in the details from the electrical subcontractor to the excavation contractor was responsible for that accident. And that's the biggest cost. Signing this, I can't even do that if I sign this agreement. It's out of my, I can't do it anymore. I appreciate the time. We support this bill.
Questions, comments?
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Nathan Phillips, Brian Krieg, and Rich Angstrom.
Gentlemen. Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, and other members. My name is Nathan Phillips. I'm here representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, and I am an electrical specialty contractor in Eugene. We are a small fire alarm business, and we sign these contracts every day, and we consider them to be quite unfair. We don't really have any option when we're presented with these contracts. In fact, when we bid these contracts, we're given a bid form by general contractors often, and here's, I'm going to read to you a clause from a bid qualification proposal form from the largest general contractor in the state, which says that we have to agree that we reviewed the proposed subcontract, including attachments thereto, and agree to execute the agreement without exception and provide the insurance specified therein. So if we're even going to bid the job, we're going to agree to this language. Then we get the contract. And the contract says something like this, and this is from a contractor who does a lot of work in our state, who's one of the largest contractors actually in the world. And they say that we have to indemnify and hold harmless the owner and the general contractor and all of their associated parties from damages associated with arising out of the work, whether or not any such damage or loss is due to the negligence of any kind or character or other fault of any one or more of the indemnified parties or breach of any statutory duty, contractual obligation, or other obligation on the part of one or more of the indemnified parties. So they can do something illegal, they can be negligent, they can fail to honor their own contract, and we have to indemnify them against that damage. We don't have any choice, we have to sign the contract or we don't work.
Sounds like you read them too.
Hmm?
You also read them.
I also read them, yeah. I'm one of the
Gary.
I guess Dan and I are the only ones that do.
Well, we're going to give you credit today at least. I don't know. Okay,
and,
please.
I would also like to point out, just with regard to some of the previous discussion, that if these provisions that we're asking for are put into law, the subcontractor will still indemnify the general contractor against losses and damages that are a result of their own actions and negligence. This doesn't prevent the general contractor from recovering against the sub if the sub is at fault. This is really about shifting the responsibility for negligence from the general to the sub. They're trying to push that responsibility and that risk down to the party with the least amount of power in the relationship. If they're at fault, they should insure against the risk, and they should pay the cost of that insurance and pay the cost of the claim. If they're not at fault and the sub is, then the sub should. would also like to say that this is not about workers' comp. It's not about the ELLA issue, and that if, to the extent that that needs to be reformed, we are certainly open to participating in that discussion during the interim. This is really about the negligent party assuming responsibility for their own negligent acts and not shifting that responsibility down to the smaller party who has no authority to or no ability to successfully negotiate the contract. I've taken these contracts to my legal counsel repeatedly when I get them, and I'm always advised not to sign it. And it's a business decision that you have to make. Are you going to stay in business? Do you have any work? Or are you going to sign these onerous contracts? And when they're this grossly unfair, in my view, it ought to be a matter of public policy that kind of language is not permitted.
Chair Schaffler?
Yeah, I would like copies of that. That's language right out of a contract, right out of two contracts, correct? Okay. I would like copies of that given to the administrator and everyone up on this dais to have a copy of that. Unbelievable.
Yep. If you'll just give it to Shelley, that would help. Questions, comments? Okay. Let's go on, please.
Chair Kenemer, Co-Chair Schaffler. For the record, Brian Krieg, representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. I'll keep it short in that many people in front of me have laid this out very eloquently. It is a situation about who taking the responsibility that you're responsible for. And my contractors are more than willing to take those costs on to ensure their company, their people, and take care of them if they have a problem, if there has been negligence, if someone is hurt. But we can't insure everybody else. We can't take those costs on. It's an expensive item. You've heard about it. Comes in quite often. My contractors say it's another piece of paper in the 11th hour that comes in front of them. They're sitting there. They can't turn the work down. They have to sign away their rights. The potential expenses are staggering. These are small businesses. This is a way to help them. We encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Engstrom.
Chairs, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rich Engstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I represent all of the construction materials associated with concrete, aggregate, and oftentimes asphalt, depending on the issue within the capital here. I participated in the work group that went on for about 6 months that included all of the parties. We had at least four or five meetings.
And we were pretty forgettable.
Yes.
You know,
especially from one of my members.
I'm sorry that I had to be so ungracious, but I just thought it was worth the shot, you know, and it was too good to pass. Thank you.
I was getting ripped back here.
Okay, good. Well, you should have.
We spent considerable time on a lot of these issues that you're hearing. In fact, the very first day this ELA issue came up, and what we said, and we all agreed to, is we would work with all the parties and work on this ELA issue. It is different than this issue, and I'm going to go through that a little bit. Where our focus was, believe it or not, was whether this law was necessary, because we were saying these provisions are showing up, and everybody in the room agreed they were illegal. And they're showing up in contracts all over the place. And we're having a debate with the bar and other members of the committee that had concerns of whether the bill is even necessary, because the interpretation from the majority of the legal community was that it wasn't necessary. It was already barred by 3140. And I think the one thing that's happened in the last 24 hours with the objection that came in is it's proved the case that we have been advocating that it was necessary. That there are generals out there that are imposing these things and think that they're legal. Because I would bet that a general contractor would not be trying to push an illegal a provision that he thought was illegal. So we worked through that, and that was one of the issues that was raised specifically by the lawyers involved. So that's where our focus was, believe it or not, because we addressed that first issue right off the bat, and we're committed to that. But I think what's also important is why we chose this method. We had basically three choices. We could have let these provisions run their normal course and waited for a certain court case to come up that the provision was challenged, and then allowed it to work through the court system. Walsh, I think, took 6 to 8 years. there's a lot of construction and a lot of these contracts that can be put in place within that period of time. We thought that was too long, too costly, and not the way to go. We thought, because we all agreed they were illegal, that those participating in the work group, that we could create a penalty section and say, hey, if you violate ORS 3140, there should be some penalty associated with it. We thought that was too harsh. What we thought was the most gentlemanly way, the lowest key way to approach this, was just to clarify that ORS 3140, and now we'll have this new provision, precludes these subrogation waivers. And it's a very low-key approach that doesn't step on the minimum amount of toes. And that's, in my mind, that's good legislation to bring a consensus to bring consensus onto a bill like this. Because we were sensitive to one of the things Chair Kenner brought to our attention, which was he doesn't really like people that are friends with Biden. And we are all friends. We just disagree on this particular issue.
So, the issues around the Employer Liability Act, we've agreed that it's again surfaced in the last 24 hours. We have agreed that we want to work on those issues, and there are some issues that have come up. One of them is when there's limited exposure by the general, and he's so he has limited liability, and he's sued under the ELA. That's one of the issues that we got to look at. Another one is offsets and awards. When an employee receives award under workers' comp, and then he chooses to sue under ELA, that award, or that payment, I should say, under workers' comp, should be put into the mix so there isn't the double payment scenarios that we've heard are possible. So, and one of the last things I should point on this is that ELA is actually an older law. And when the workers' comp law was actually passed, they didn't harmonize the two. And so what needs to be worked on is making those things more harmonic, for a better way of putting it. So we're on board on that. I've talked with labor. Labor even wants to sit down and talk about this. AGC wants to talk about it. Everybody in that room believe that this needs to be addressed. So the last couple of points I'm going to make, there's two policy choices that are here for you folks. One of them is this ELA issue that's been brought up and harmonizing it. It's a different approach. The cases are created by an employee, not through contract. They're whole different statutes. They address two different laws that are entirely different than these contract ORS 3140 provision. And they do need to be addressed, but they are different than the other policy choice, which is everybody should cover their own costs when it comes to liability. And that's what 3140 is about. So from a policy side, we've separated them. We've acknowledged that there's issues with both, but this addresses one of those issues. And we will work hard in the interim and bring hopefully a consensus solution to resolve the other. My closing comment. The argument against this bill goes like this. If we fix the ELA issue and harmonize ELA with workers' comp law, then the provisions barring subrogation claims would go away. I submit to you they would not. They're exclusive. We would still see those from general contractors coming in, and it's because they're associated with the restitution. For folks that are new to this, and it takes a while to get a handle on this, subrogation, you can substitute restitution for the word subrogation. All that's being said is when a subcontractor covers the cost of an employee through a workers' comp claim and the general is negligent, that subcontractor can get restitution from the general for his share of the responsibility. It only comes up in that scenario. With that, I would urge your support. This is a good bill. It's been hard worked. We appreciate the issue that has again surfaced. We will address it, but we need to address that issue separate from this issue. Thank you.
Any questions, comments?
Representative Conger.
Just one question, probably for all three of you, or any of you can answer. If every subcontractor is being required to sign this kind of a provision, so every subcontractor is, when they're bidding, they know that they're going to have to insure against this risk, and they know it's going to cost money. Isn't that cost just being passed through in the contract anyway? It's just a question of who pulls the insurance policy at that point.
Well, I can tell you from my experience through the chair that it's very difficult to purchase insurance against the negligent acts of another party. And when you go to your insurance agent and you ask them to insure you for actions by some other third party that is not you, it's hard for them to underwrite that risk. And so they frequently won't insure it, or it's very costly.
I was going to say, I'm not sure it's hard. I think it's expensive.
Expensive, if not impossible.
Impossible.
Yeah. But though, you know, theoretically possible, but it seems logical and most efficient and least costly to have the negligent party, the potentially negligent party, buy their own insurance.
Let me be clear, I'm definitely not arguing that point. I am supportive of the policy question here of, you know, who should bear the responsibility for their own inaction or bad actions or whatever it might be. To be clear, my question is, you are getting this risk insured as a subcontractor, right? Your members are insuring for this risk, or you wouldn't be getting these contracts.
I would say, again, through the chair, in my experience, I would say at times we are insuring against it. Sometimes we're not. We probably won't know unless there's a claim. You know, whether our insurance company will respond to it, we won't find out until we file the claim.
I'm sorry. I thought there was earlier testimony, Mr. Chair, that said that you would take the contract and you would present it to your insurer, and then you would get a binder on that project.
I can only speak to my own experience. When I've presented these contracts to my insurer, sometimes they've issued a binder. Sometimes they've said, your insurance covers this. Sometimes they've said, we won't cover this. And sometimes they've said, we won't know until we see what the claim is. So it's very uncertain because you're insuring against something that's outside of your control.
Okay, I don't think I'm getting a real clear answer to my question, but in the interest of time, let's just...
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. At this point, this is all I have signed up. I assume there are some others who wish to testify. Is there anyone else wishing to testify?
I do.
Okay. Please, give us your name and let's proceed.
My name is Dan Harmon. I'm Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Hoffman Corporation. Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members. I am here today to express my opposition to Senate Bill 961. I'm mindful of Representative Schaffler's earlier comments about being late to the party. I do have to profess I've spent the last couple months creating jobs and been darn busy at it.
God bless you.
And you're going to see a few thousand jobs, and it'll be reported in the Oregonian. You'll see some of the work that we've been doing to create those jobs. Having said that, I've made my views very clear all throughout their work group process through my associates, the construction law section, as well as some folks I know at AGC. If this bill was just about, as has been testified to, restitution for workers' compensation, i.e. eliminating subrogation waivers and workers' compensation payments, I wouldn't have a problem with it. But it's not. If it was, it'd be tied to the workers' compensation statutes. It is not. If this was about making sure that the negligent parties should pay, I wouldn't have a problem with that either. But it's not. And you can see that in the bill itself. On the one hand, the subcontract community does not want to be responsible for their negligence in terms of if they burn down the building. They don't. It's there. They want a waiver of subrogation to stay in place for any property insurance, regardless of their negligence. On the other hand, they want the contractor to be responsible, owner to be responsible for their negligence. And I'll get into that negligence in a second and talk about what that really is. Finally, I got to tell you, they are getting paid for the insurance. We make it very clear in our subcontract, you will provide the insurance. Our language is different than the language that was quoted earlier. That's not ours. Our language includes the words "to the extent of your negligence," which we think is right and proper. But we do require that they provide the insurance. We do tell them to get it, and they do get paid for it on the subcontract price. So they're being paid, and they can get it. Oregon has a very unique system, one really like no other state really in the country. When Oregon chose to implement workers' compensation, unlike many other states, virtually every state, they did not repeal their Employers' Liability Act. That act sat on the books unused for many, many years until the late 70s and early 80s. The Supreme Court ruled in a series of cases that for construction projects, which they consider to be common enterprises, that for the purposes of the ELA, a subcontractor's employee could be deemed the employee of the contractor and the owner and be sued under the ELA. It set up the situation where a injured subcontractor's employee could fully recover workers' compensation and then turn around and file an ELA claim against the owner and the general contractor. I have seven of them that have come in the last 3 months. I'll describe a couple for you. Subcontractor's worker injured his back lifting a piece of equipment with his co-workers. Now, I want to know where Hoffman's negligence was in that. The subcontractor's employee stumbled over a threshold and hyperextended their knee. Where's Hoffman's negligence in that? The one that is really great is at the State Hospital Project, where an individual pressurized a line for hydrotesting purposes, left it overnight, forgot to remember that he had it under pressure, and removed the end cap. Where's Hoffman's negligence in that? What happens under this system?
Were you found negligent?
No, we're still fighting with the subcontractors insurance carriers to take those because they don't want to accept that negligence, that responsibility.
Okay.
So what happens under the system is we get sued, the owner gets sued. Mm-hmm. And what we get sued for is basically because the subcontractor failed to do his job to protect his workers from injury. And as a consequence, they argue that we didn't do everything to ensure that they didn't fail to do their job. That's the lawsuit. The contractual approach since the 80s by everyone, and I mean everyone, and there are some people that have testified today that use exactly the same contractual approach with their sub-tier subcontractors. I've seen their documents.
They won't be able to after this bill passes.
It's used by public works,
they won't be able to have
the state, municipalities, private owners, general contractors, and subcontractors when they subcontract work. And that is to require the lower tier to obtain specific insurance, to name the upstream parties as additional insureds, and to waive subrogation. This bill seeks to undo that. It will increase litigation. What will happen is the injured employee will get comp coverage, his benefits. He will turn around, he will sue the general, and the owner will tender it back to the insurance carriers. Under our language, where we can show there's negligence on the part of the subcontractors, your insurance carrier will, or them, if they're self-insured, which some of the folks that testified today are, will have to respond to the claim, pay the claim, and then they'll seek to themselves sue the owner and the general contractor. It's not going to work. This bill won't work. I know enough about this to know that there are ways to enforce this particular approach without requiring a waiver of subrogation. And I know that there's language being drafted in the event that this passes to do just that. And my concern, obviously, having seen that language and had discussions with folks about that language, is it is going to make it much more difficult for subcontractors. What really is the problem? The problem is ELA. I said it from the very beginning. First work group session, the communique I sent passed through was, you're fishing in the wrong hole here. It's ELA. We tried to fix it when I was in the governor's task force in 99, when I wrote the workers' compensation reform statute that exists. I couldn't get labor and the trial attorneys fully on board. We did make some inroads by adding a section that made comparative negligence and the standard, which in effect says that if the employee is more than 50% responsible, he may be barred from recovery. That's as far as we got. So my view is, if you really want to solve the problem, don't vote this out of committee, send everybody back, let's get to work on the ELA. That's really where the problem is. We can probably solve some of these other things that sort of tangentially run around this issue, but that's the heart of the matter. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Schaffer.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. I appreciate it, and I do appreciate creating jobs out there, and I wish this legislature were creating more jobs to put more of your workers to work. Believe me, and this committee here has fought like hell to try and do that, and we agree and we applaud your efforts. But we have this bill before us, and there's a problem, and everyone recognizes that. I don't know anything about your cases, but we're not here arguing your cases. We're not trying your cases. I'm not even interested in your cases unless it has to do with safety, health, and welfare of the people I represent, which may. So that's good luck. I wish you luck on that. And as it's been said, you say it's about the ELA. I got a whole room full of people that say it ain't. They even recognize this problem. My question is, why should I be responsible for his negligence? It isn't right. It doesn't make sense, therefore it's not right. That's what Judge Judy says. If it doesn't make sense, it's not right. It doesn't make sense. And if your contract...
That's a new line.
I've used it before, but maybe people weren't listening.
Maybe I missed it.
And if your contract language is different from what we just heard, mm-hmm. I don't think you have anything to fear from this bill then. I've got a whole long list. The subcontractors may use the same language, and I have no reason not to believe you, Mr. Harmon. You're a credible guy, and I enjoy working with you. But if they're using the same language currently in theirs, after this bill passes, guess what? They ain't going to be able to anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, increase of litigation. I hear that dire prediction all the time. It's going to increase litigation. You know what? As long as we're cranking out trial lawyers, we're going to increase litigation in this country. You know, we talk about, you know, who's at fault. You buy a ladder, you lean it up against to a barn with ground frozen, you don't tie it off because you don't know what you're doing, you climb up on your barn, you climb down, the ground's thawed out. This is a case used when I was in college in the 80s. The farmer falls and breaks his head, now all of a sudden the ladder company's responsible. That's why they have those nice directions for those who are intelligent enough to read them. So the dire prediction thing, I really, really, really don't buy. As you know, we're going to pass 1,000 bills this year. God knows what some trial lawyer is going to make of all that. But the dealing with the ELA, look, I agree. We've had this, it's in tort, Med-Mal, personal injury policy, this, all this stuff's been for this committee over the years. If someone's injured, the responsible party makes them whole, that's all they should be asking for. They shouldn't get a gazillion more dollars just because of a horrible accident. I want them made whole. I want them taken care of. I think that there's a lot of logic in the sense there, and I'm sympathetic. I'm not committing to any language yet because I don't have any language in front of me. Mm-hmm. But I do have this language in front of me, and I think it's a good bill, and I hope we pass it out of committee today. But I'll let you respond. If you want me to repeat any of this, I'd be happy to.
I'm good. I'll try to respond to each of the questions. Thank you, Representative Schaffer, and committee members and chairs. I presented our cases because Senator Morris talked about a case, and Mr. Frey talked about a case, his cases, to let you see the other side of the story. I would tell you that it is very rare when a general contractor is actively negligent in these cases. It's passive negligence, and I think Representative Johnson made the point, which is, you know, negligence is in the eye of the beholder, and it's a very nebulous concept. We are being sued for passive negligence arising from the negligent acts of the subcontractor, in effect, failing to perform their duty. Now, you know, I've had conversations with you, Representative Schaffer, before about my concerns. You know, we take safety very, very seriously. And I have a real bone to pick with the subcontractor community, which is a totally different subject about their engagement in safety right now. Having said that, I do believe it will increase litigation. I'm not saying that it could be somewhat, I mean, I've talked to the trial lawyers, I've talked to people out there. This will create another layer of litigation. It won't be over when the claim is resolved with the injured worker, is my point. But I think the bigger point that people need to understand is this bill's not going to solve anything. The folks behind me that are proponents will be back here next session because it really doesn't solve the underlying problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Harmon, yeah, thank you. I hope they are back there with you. I hope they're here with you. Mm-hmm. And I hope we're all in this room solving this problem. That's really what I think everyone in this room wants to see happen. So I hope that prediction is right. I do appreciate professionalism. You got to put up with a layman, hard-legged laborer like me, but that's the way it goes.
Pretty darn smart one, though.
Yeah.
An ex-employee.
I wasn't fired, Mr. Chair. I was laid off.
Oh, excuse me. I didn't imply that, did I? Are there any further questions or comments? Representative Conger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harmon, I appreciate your testimony. Also appreciate the fact that you took the time to explain your position offline to me as well. It was very helpful. So did the other, the advocates for the other side of this bill. My question for you is, how do you respond? I actually have a couple of questions, I think, but the first one is just, how do you respond to the underlying purpose of this bill, which is to clarify a statute that on its face seems to be saying liability should rest with the party who is negligent?
Well, initially it was to be integrated into that section, and now it's its own separate section. Initially the effort from the work group, as I understood it, was to incorporate into 3140. It's now a separate section. Having said that, 3140 is pretty clear that you cannot... And if people use the term illegal, I would have to tell you that's probably not the right term. The statute is very clear to say that if you require one party requires another party or that party's insurer to indemnify another party from that party's negligence, such a provision shall be deemed void, and it's deemed void. Once again, it's how it's drafted. Everyone talks about the Walsh case. Well, you got to go to federal court and you can look up Hoffman versus Travelers. That's the federal court companion case. We won that case. Our language was determined not to be void. Our language is determined to require the subcontractor only to be responsible for their negligence. But we had to fight the subcontractor and his insurance carrier to get there all the way through federal district court. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but the intention I think of this is to create a situation where the contractor is going to be under some pressure not to tender this claim back to the subcontractor's insurance carrier because they can go settle the case and then come back with a subrogation action. That's what I believe the intention is of it.
Could you say that again? Question. Yeah, please. Just the last part there, I don't think I followed you. I think you were trying to answer the underlying question.
Yeah,
I just missed it.
Yes, and let me maybe take this a different direction. It'll help you there. You heard people today say that they didn't think it was necessary and it was all encompassed in there. And you have to ask them, why are you doing this? Okay. And I've asked myself that a lot. And if it was just about comp, you would go to the comp section and you'd amend the comp section and say there should be no waiver of subrogation of any comp claims. That would be very simple. That's not what this seeks to do. What this seeks to do is to create a situation that in the event that they are forced to indemnify the contractor for their negligence, that they get to pay the claim and then they have a subrogation action back against the contractor asserting negligence on the part of the contractor. That's what it is. and it's just attempting to shift the hot potato back. My point is that's all this is about, and at some point we've got to throw away the hot potato.
Which, and I agree with that last statement. May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Conger.
I think that you are correct, but the intent of 961, including the amendment, the A3 amendment as I read it, is consistent with the way that I read the original 3140, which is to say, as a policy matter, we want as much as we can, and we can't, you know, as a legislature, we can't keep people from making specious claims in court. That's impossible. The best we can do is try to make our intent clear so that it's easy for the court to interpret the law. And again, the intent, I think, is to assign liability to the person, the party acting negligently, so that they have a disincentive to act negligently. Because ultimately, we'd rather that people don't get injured.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But I think that what you're doing here is, 3140 itself, you know, I think is a pretty good statute, and it's worked fine. Because if a subcontractor, I've had these situations where a subcontractor's insurance carrier comes back and says, there's no evidence of negligence on the part of my insured. Okay. But what I'm concerned about is the possibility that this bill, it's so broad in terms of what it tries to do, that it does in fact cut off their responsibility and limit it just to workers' compensation.
Could you explain, and I don't know, have you seen the Dash 3 amendments? I think that's what should be working from. Could you explain just quickly for the benefit of the committee, I think, but certainly for my benefit, what language in there specifically that you think might do that? Because that would be a concern. We don't want to, you know, err on the side by trying to fix allocation of liability here. We don't want to err on the side of, you know, imbalancing it the other way, I guess.
I don't have a copy of the A3 amendment in front of me.
And mine.
We're actually...
I'm not trying to push you on
this. No.
Shelley, why don't you give that to Conger?
Well, I think it's Representative Conger. It's the first provision where it says that it deals with waiving the right of subrogation, and that idea is basically that it allows the subcontractor who is negligent to come back and sue, make assertions against the general contractor and the owner for their negligence, whatever that might be. Now, and like I'm telling you, in most cases, that is passive negligence.
Okay, I think I understand what you're getting at, and is it your intent to work this today, or are we going to?
Actually, it's my intent to hold a brief recess and have a little discussion about the future of this bill.
One last question.
Yes, Representative Dorsey.
And this is, I don't mean this in the way it may kind of come out to say, but are Hoffman's and some of the bigs willing to voluntarily no longer put those in the contracts?
Well,
if this apparently is not as much of a problem as we say, are you voluntarily willing to not have that in your contracts to subs?
Representative Dorsey, what happens is the contracts we get from the owners, including the state, dictate the terms that we have to pass down to the subcontractors. So, for example, we'll get a contract from the owner, and the owner will say just exactly this. You shall require all subcontractors to acquire $2 million for the general liability insurance. That general liability insurance shall be primary non-contributory. It shall expressly name...
Yeah.
And then that's a contractual term. If we don't comply with that, we're in breach of contract.
But it's not the idea that you would voluntarily say that you have to have liability insurance that also covers me as the general, or is it prime?
Well,
to me, that's the issue that's in front of us.
Well, that goes to the issue of the indemnification provision. That you're right. Now, ours is written to say to the extent of their negligence, and I would expect, and we see it all the time, that a carrier, if there's a claim and someone's injured, and we believe the subcontractor is responsible for it, we tender it to the insurance carrier, and we get a letter back that says from the carrier, we're accepting the claim, but we're making reservations of rights as to the only to the extent of the subcontractor's negligence.
Okay. Anything? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a practical example of a situation. Tell me what you think about this, or what would be your interpretation of what might happen. Okay, on one of your projects, or a project where you have multiple subcontractors operating in the same environment together at the same time. Let's just say you've got an electrician who's trimming out some interior electrical stuff, plugs, switches, lights, whatever. You also happen to have a painting contractor on the job site at the same time in that same environment. The painter leaves a can of paint out. The electrician trips over the can of paint. He's injured. Who then would be the individual that's at fault, or the party that's at fault? Would it be the painter who was doing his job, the electrician who perhaps should have taken better care to not trip over that can of paint, or is it the general, perhaps, who was negligent because he simply scheduled two subs in the same environment at the same time? Where's the fault in that situation? From your experience,
yeah, in 15 seconds or less,
these are real life situations, and they happen. As ridiculous as they may seem, somebody wants to be at fault.
Right.
Somebody needs to recoup their damages. Where would that come from?
Co-chairs Ripson Johnson, those cases happen.
I know they do.
They do happen. Everybody gets sued, and it's an interesting deal because negligence is a factual question to be determined by the trier of fact in a jury trial. So that whole process, my guess is. there'd be a claim that the painter shouldn't have had the can on the floor. There'd be a cross claim back for contribution because the electrician shouldn't have, tripped over it, should have been aware of it. There'd be a claim against Hoffman for, passively failing to make sure that the subcontractor didn't leave the can of paint on the floor or for scheduling or whatever. That's the environment we live in.
But my question would be, is this legislation as proposed going to do anything to clarify that situation?
No. Not at all.
Contract language. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Also, Mr. Rakowitz, it's been told that AGC is neutral on this bill. And let the record show there was a head nod.
Okay. As we had discussed, it would be my intention to close this hearing at this point. I'd like to take a brief recess, if I could. So we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 961. And we will have a brief recess, and then we will continue on either in work session or on the next bill.
We'll resume the hearing on our the Business and Labor Committee. And at this point, we will move into a work session on Senate Bill 961.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Chair Schaffler?
I move
dash
3 is Senate Bill 961.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves the dash 3A3 amendments to Senate Bill 961. Is there any discussion? Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some real concerns about the effectiveness of this, about the potential that some of the concerns raised in testimony will become reality, and that ultimately the bill will not be effective at resolving the problem that it's intended to resolve, which I think is clarifying where liability should fall for negligence. And on the other hand, and actually I have a concern also that the underlying problem is not being addressed, which is why this will happen. The underlying problem is something that was discussed. I would hope that we could work on it in the interim. I would hope that we can have the commitment of the parties who brought this bill, the proponents as well as the opponents, to get that resolved and get it done in February. But I have decided to vote in favor of this because I think that the underlying policy should be clarified. Although this isn't a solution because it's not attacking the real problem, it's probably helpful in the long run to clarify our intent legislatively, and I think that the language of the bill speaks for itself in the sense that it eliminates or avoids a waiver of the right of someone to claim against a third party for negligence. For that third party's negligence. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We're on the topic of the amendment at the moment, however.
This is the amendment. I'm sorry, I should have said the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion regarding the amendment? Is there any objection to adding the amendment? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Chair Schaffler. I move Senate Bill 961 as amended floor to pass recommendation.
Chair Schaffler moves Senate Bill 961 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think Representative Conger has made the idea, has broached the notion of looking at the ELA as an issue. One of the things that Chair Schaffler and I have been talking about is what we're going to do for a work plan. I don't know if that's the right place to put it, but I think clearly it's been put as an issue that needs to be resolved. The anticipation is that next Wednesday we have a couple of bills left to finish up on, and then we will have a discussion with the full committee about interim work committee workload. Chair Schaffler, do you have a comment?
Sure. Yeah, and I completely agree with us not just leaving this alone for the interim. I think we've heard some great arguments from proponents and opponents about why we need to continue this conversation and solve some of these problems in February. I share my friend and colleague's concerns about the potential effectiveness of this. I can't predict the future. I'm certainly not an attorney. I agree that there is another problem, an underlying problem, that is probably what's brought us here. It has brought us here in the first place.
That's right.
But for the life of me, I cannot support contractual language in this state that says very clearly that one party is responsible for the negligence of another. That just doesn't make sense. Therefore, I'm obviously in support of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's also been brought to my attention by staff that perhaps I didn't clarify correctly earlier. AGC is neutral if we're talking about these dash 3 amendments that have now been put into the bill. They were not
neutral prior to that. So I do want to clarify that for the record. Okay, is there further discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of those situations where you find yourself wishing there might be a third way, I suppose, but we don't have that option in this setting. But I think I would second Representative Conger's comments that there obviously is a situation here that I don't think is remedied by this legislation, and I would just encourage us to do everything within our power as a committee to see that we can bring some sort of resolution or additional clarity to that, and I, for one, would be willing to work long and hard to do what I can do to be a positive contributor to that process. So I can support the bill, but I would support forwarding it on to the House and allowing some of our other colleagues to have a chance to weigh in on this matter as well.
Okay. Any further discussion or comment? Okay. A motion is before us to move Senate Bill 961 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is seeing no further discussion, is there any objection? Seeing none, it is unanimous, so ordered.
Be excused, Representative.
Oh, yes, and thank you. And for the record, please note that Representative Matthews is excused. So it is unanimous among the seven. Okay, thank you very much. Chair Schaffler?
This merit the consent calendar, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I would volunteer to carry this bill.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate you volunteering to carry this bill. Somebody needs to do that.
Unless you want to do it.
You know, I think maybe I'll leave it with you.
All right, sir. Thank you.
We could co-carry it if you'd
like to.
No, I'll give you the privilege.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, our final bill is a hearing on Senate Bill 237, and before I open that, I don't know, our Republican caucus, I don't know about the Democrats, started 15 minutes ago. What I would suggest, committee members, I hope you can stay with us for a few minutes. At this point, I don't anticipate being able to move this bill today. But some people have come to testify. I'd like to honor that in some brief form if we could. So that would, and make the best of it. I'm sorry, our timeline moved longer than I, as you can tell, we tried to. Okay, I think with that then, we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 237.
Mr. Chair, members, we heard first heard Senate Bill 237 on April 27th. The measure extends whistleblower protection for hospital nursing staff to include additional hospital staff. You have in front of you, members, a -4 amendment, which replaces the measure language. It expands the current statutory definition of nursing staff to include nurse practitioners and also establishes a definition of health care provider, which is the nursing staff or physician or physician's assistant employed by contracting with or affiliated with a hospital. The measure then in turn extends whistleblower protection to health care providers, and it maintains the emergency clause effect upon passage. With the amendment, and actually with the original version, there is a fiscal statement that has been issued, and members, you all have received that. To summarize, because the number of cases that cannot be interpreted, and then when a whistleblower case is filed, it goes to the Boley Civil Rights Division. Since they cannot predict the number, the fiscal impact would be indeterminate. But there has been a statement that's been issued, and that would be also extended to the original measures provisions as well.
Okay. And the list of for testimony?
Well, it's a work session, Mr. Chair, so.
Excuse me. Okay. Let's have the proponents for the amendments come up. And did I open it as a work session?
Yes, you did, Mr. Chair.
Evidently, the last one. Evidently, I got caught up in that.
Yes. I'd like to stress brevity. This bill is not going to pass out today. I was wondering if someone from the hospitals wanted to come up and briefly speak at this time, too, with your indulgence.
Absolutely.
Take care of it all right
prudent
now.
And, yeah.
Co-chairs Kenimer and Schaffler, Josh Ballack, testifying on behalf of MVP Health Authority, which is made up of 500 physicians serving Polk, Marion, and Yamhill counties. Our physician who was going to testify today unfortunately got called into surgery, so he couldn't be here. We believe that this bill is very important to our provider members, that extending whistleblower protections to them is incredibly important to make sure that we've got an extra set of eyes to keep our hospitals safe. we would acknowledge that the original bill that was passed the Senate unanimously, 30-0, no votes, and that I believe the Hospital Association actually testified that they would be neutral on that. We would be perfectly fine with that bill passing, if that was acceptable. We did try to address some of the concerns that some of the members had on the committee, and we came up with -4 amendments, and we found out that the hospitals had a little bit of an issue with that particular some of that language. We would welcome an opportunity to work through that, but if we can't get there, we think that since the Senate passed the 30-0, and the Hospital Association didn't have a problem with the underlying bill would be acceptable as well.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for making that brief. Please.
Chair Kinnemer, Chair Schaffler, and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, representing Oregon's 58 community care hospitals, who also employ roughly 54,000 or more full and part-time employees. We did testify in the Senate Healthcare in as a neutral position, but we did claim, as we did in front of your committee back in April, that we think current state law and federal law covers all employees. We do raise concerns, though, around the various dash amendments, including the -4 amendments. One is that there's unclear language and that could be unintended consequences. That unclear language is around the affiliated. It does define what affiliated hospital is, as being a hospital that's doing business with another hospital, but it does not imply what affiliated provider may be. We also are concerned that the majority of the remedies in the statute are employment-related, such as reinstatement, compensation for lost wages, and benefits. It is unclear how these remedies would apply to non-employed providers. And if it were to be determined to the courts, that litigation could be very expensive and costly to hospitals as well as to our communities. We have concerns around patient safety with these new amendments. Studies have shown that disruptive incivility and hostile environments are not safe places for patients, and errors do happen in those types of environments. These amendments, we fear, would impair the ability of the medical staff to carry out their responsibility to ensure high quality and safety for our patients. Good faith actions taken by a hospital or medical staff against a disruptive, harassing, low-quality, poor-performance physician could be determined alleged by retaliation under these new amendments. I would like to turn it over to Dr. Holloway, Medical Director of Salem Health, to talk about how medical bylaws currently protect physicians and other medical staff in the hospital.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please. Good morning. So my name is David Holloway. I'm the chief medical officer and a physician. I work for Salem Health and Salem Hospital. And my concerns with the amendments are from the physician viewpoint. And so the physicians already in the state of Oregon and every other state have a really strong set of protections already built in. And the Oregon statutes are amazingly clear. And it starts off discussing that the governing body is really responsible, so there's a board of trustees. And it goes on to say the governing body then directs the medical staff to form an organization, and they create bylaws. And so the physicians are really leading themselves under the statute. And it's interesting, the way most physicians approach this in their bylaws is they form sections around specialties. They elect a section chief. So at Salem Hospital, we have 25 different sections, so ENT, orthopedics. Those 25 sections then collapse into three different divisions. So each of those then has an elected chair, and then finally there's a medical executive committee. They're elected members as well by the medical staff. And really, any issues that come up around patient safety or disruptive physicians is managed by that organization. And administration does not enter into any sort of corrective action at any level.
So, for example, if there is a disruptive, alleged disruptive physician in the middle of the night, which typically might be a physician receiving a call from a nurse on a lab value that the nurse thinks might be critical, or perhaps to clarify a medication order, and that physician is perhaps sarcastic or reacts angrily, in the past this was acceptable. In fact, when I started in medicine, this was kind of how it was done. But we know now, first of all, it's just basic human dignity in 2011. This is not acceptable. But set that aside, it's study after study have showed that nurse is now going to hesitate the next time she needs to call that physician. And that's potentially a safety issue. And most of my colleagues would rather get that call because, you don't want to come back the next morning and find that the troponin levels were elevated and I should have been notified of this heart attack. So we really are talking about those few physicians that in 2011 will still react angrily. Nurses then, so you can see how this would be a safety issue. But where that would go then would be to the Medical Staff Behavioral Committee. Believe it or not, the physicians organize a committee. These are elected members of the medical staff. That complaint, if the nurse were to file a complaint, would go to this medical staff behavioral committee. Typically, these are handled the first, second incident in what we call a collegial intervention. So the section chief would take that, go sit down, have a cup of coffee, say, Dave, you can't do that anymore kind of thing. 9 times out of 10, that takes care of it. If, however, there's a second, third incident, it might go up the chain to the department chair or even to the medical executive committee. And really, the medical executive committee, under the bylaws, is the only authority that can suspend, remove privileges, and then even that recommendation then would finally go to the Board of Trustees for final action. Even before a final action that would suspend or remove privileges, there is a fair hearing process where a panel of the physician's peers would gather and hear the evidence, and then they would make an independent recommendation to the Board of Trustees before they made their final action. So it's physicians leading physicians, and I'm concerned that the amendments to this bill would only confuse this physicians leading physicians under the bylaws.
Thank you very much. Chair Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't have a neutral button on the floor. All right? It's either yes or no. Up or down. Anything but a yes is a no. Anything but a no is a yes. That's the world I live in. So the hospitals are neutral on the underlying bill. That means it doesn't matter one way or the other if the bill passes or fails. You have no concerns. If I have concerns about a bill, then I'm afraid something bad is going to happen as a result of that passage of that bill. I vote no. That's how I do it. And that's how everybody does it. There's no other way to do it. So concerns and neutral, that's an oxymoron. You can't be concerned and be neutral. You're neutral. You have no concerns, zero concerns about the passage or non-passage of the bill, underlying bill. Is that correct?
Chair Kenemer and Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, that is correct. We are okay with the underlining passage of 237.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thanks for the process you just described. Does that process apply equally to physicians who are employed by the hospital, let's just say, who are Providence docs, whomever, Salem Hospital docs, as well as docs who are a part of an outside entity that simply have privileges within that hospital? Are they covered equally within the process that you outlined?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions, comments? Thank you very much. Whoops. Representative Compton.
Sorry, I'll just mention that I did contact my local hospital, St. Charles, and had that same conversation. It was very consistent with your testimony. I appreciate that. I'm not sure that necessarily, I think it weighs against creating too much protection for the whistleblower because it might actually have the opposite effect that we're trying for, which is patient safety. So that's why I appreciate it. I'm not sure that it argues that you shouldn't have whistleblower protection for docs as well or other medical staff because you do want them to feel empowered to make the complaint in the first place. My only comment about this is I agree. I'm not sure. I don't understand why the bill is necessary. I haven't been convinced that we need to have this bill in order to protect medical staff. I think they're already protected and enabled to make these reports, and I don't see any evidence that there's suppression of that.
Okay. Representative Doherty.
Okay. My question is kind of based on knowing the hospital culture that goes on. Is the reason for this, because, I mean, whistleblower laws are pretty clear, it covers employees. Is the purpose for this bill just to kind of go through and let some of the folks that are like certified nurse assistants and others know that they have the right to go through and whistleblow on a physician? Is that, I mean...
What is the true purpose
of this?
Co-chairs Schaffler and Kenemer, Representative Doherty, yes, that's part of the reason to do this, is to enable people, to make them feel comfortable to come forward. It's one more layer. I mean, I don't believe that there are a lot of hospitals out there trying to, you know, or physicians out there trying to, like, suppress people from doing this, but people get worried that, well, if I speak up, I might lose my job. And in this economy, and when a job is so important, you know, you want to enable these people as much as humanly possible who are taking care and making sure that we're safe in these hospitals to speak up. And
this is why I prefaced it with knowing a lot of times the hospital culture,
right,
and the medical culture. So it's one of those things. It's not totally necessary, but it doesn't hurt.
Yes, Representative Doherty.
Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't heard anything from anyone that works at any of my hospitals about this being a problem. Where did this come from?
Representative Kenemer, co-chairs Kenemer and Schaffler, Representative Esquivel. I apologize that we didn't, our physician who was going to come in and actually testify about some of the issues that he's actually seen is not able to attend because he got called away to his surgery. I am more than happy to schedule some time with anyone on the committee to be able to come in and have him come in, and when he hopefully is not being called away to perform medical procedures, to come and talk with you.
But isn't it in... We just learned that it's in law that the physicians are protected. So is this a solution looking for a problem or what here?
Co-chairs Kenemer and Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, we believe that one of the problems is that while this process does go to the medical director here explained does go to the fact that there's a process to go through, that there aren't adequate whistleblower protections in statute to be able to for specifically people with privileges, and so we would like to be able to expand that.
Yeah, follow up.
My memory serves me correct. Boley, the state of Oregon, and there is federal protection. What do you want?
Representative Esquivel, one of the things that we are particularly worried about is policies in the that there's criminal protection. So, like, if you see somebody doing something that's criminal, then absolutely you'll jump in and that all goes into place. There's a little bit of a gray area when it comes to policies. And unfortunately, I'm not an expert and can't really give a really great answer of a specific thing. But if there's a,
Go ahead.
I wish I could give a very specific answer that I knew was concrete to that specific thing. And again, I apologize for.
Chair Schaffler.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in either, but the passage of this and put in statute would encourage the hospitals to tighten up their policy. Their policy relating to whistleblowers within their business. Is that an accurate assumption or description of what we're doing here?
Representative Schaffler, it would more go to the fact that whistleblower protections would go into place if somebody called into question policies in the hospital.
Representative Hoyle?
Very quickly, does this law help bring our state law into alignment with what the federal law already says so that we have better alignment and more clear guidelines for how we should be acting?
Co-chairs Kenemer and Schaffler, Representative Hoyle. I believe it would bring more clarity. I don't know if it would bring it into alignment exactly with the federal law, but unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer.
I think it brings it into better alignment.
Okay. Thank you.
My understanding.
I think we're beyond time, and I appreciate the committee staying here. I think I would suggest the proponents and anyone else interested in this bill to maybe talk with committee members. Plan to schedule this for a possible work session on Wednesday would be the last possible time to move it out. And I guess it's pretty clear some cases need to be made on either side. So with that, I think we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 237. And we will meet on Wednesday to cover a couple of bills and to talk a little bit about interim work plan. And with that, we have adjourned business.
I'll talk to